Now entering Nerdist.com.
Hey, sex nerd Sandra here. Thanking AdamandEve.com for sponsoring this week's episode. Go to AdamandEve.com, type in sex nerd at promo code. If you do that, you get free shipping, 50% off almost anything in the store. You get 3 free DVDs and a secret gift. All the things. And I was looking at the website and I realized they carry the Palm Power Massager. The Palm Power Massager is a black and pink massager. It retails for $99.99. And it's similar to a Hitachi magic wand. It's that back massager type style, but it's much smaller and really strong. So if that's something that's up your alley, I highly recommend it. And it has an 8-foot cord. So that's a nice length to really just run around the room with it. Around the room. So go to adamandeve.com, type in sex nerd at promo code, and get 50% off almost anything in the store. It's free shipping, 3 free DVDs, and a super secret gift. Thanks, Adam and Eve.
Welcome to the Sex Nerd Sandra podcast.
Whoa, what are these kids doing in here? Hey, if you're under 18, go ask your mom. Now that we're alone, let's start the show.
All right, we have quite a show for you today. So many things. Okay, this is a pretty intense interview that's coming up. I just have to say that right up. Intense in a good way, like in a really nerdy way. Like we really get into it. And I just yeah, so much fun. But before we get to it, a few things. First, mark your calendars, Naughty Monkeys of DC. I'm teaching in Alexandria at Lotus Blooms on Sunday, March 16th. I don't know what yet. We're still figuring that out. And then I'm hosting a live podcast at The Pinch on St. Paddy's Day, March 17th. It's a Monday. So I will be at Catalyst Con East. I think I'll be on a few panels and then rocking a workshop on Sunday and a live podcast on Monday. So it's going to be a packed, really fun time in DC. So I hope to see you there. Alternately, this is sort of an odd announcement. Usually I would tell you about things that I'm going to do so that you can go and meet me there and enjoy, and we can enjoy it together. This, however, is sort of a last minute thing. I get to go on a cruise at the end of February. It's the Jonathan Colton Joko Cruise Crazy Cruise. I don't know if you know about this. He's a musician, much beloved. It's going to be a great time. The cruise is sold out. I am not trying to tell you to go to this because it's sold out. But if you are already signed up to go on this cruise, I kind of want to state some boundaries around. And really, if you see me in the world, if we catch each other in the wild, I just wanted to just acknowledge that. Will you please just come over and say hi, okay? Or at least wave. I mean, please? Because I don't feel weird about it. I think it's at some points I used to, but I really don't feel weird about it anymore. I'm way less shy now and just happy to meet people who are excited about what I'm excited about. So I'm saying this because if you're on a boat with me for 6 days and you don't say hi and you just silently look over at me across the dining room or something, I'm just going to think that I have something on my face. And I don't like feeling like I have something on my face. Welcome to my brain. But it's going to be a great time. So, and I will be teaching some workshops on the cruise just for fun. Speaking of my weird brain, feelings. If you saw my tweeting and Facebooking this week, you may have noticed that I shared a picture of instant boobs, and you'll know what I mean if you did see that. But it was to make up for the fact that this week's episode is a little late. I apologize for that. I definitely do. And I also promised that I would share as to why. I want to speak plainly to you. Because, you know, we know each other. You know, we have been around each other a while now, getting to know each other. I feel like I can really open up. I had a really hard couple of days this week because I had an intense conversation with a family member about some stuff that I really you know, it was one of those conversations that people tell you to have with a relative before, you know, anything, you know, God forbid, bad were to happen. You know, speak your piece, that sort of thing. And it's much easier just not to have those conversations. I mean, let's be honest. But it was something that was really bothering me. And it was really around really just growing up and needing to establish new boundaries of how communication and what I need. And it's, you know, regular people stuff, right? People getting along in the world. I feel better now. But I tell you, because gosh darn it, you guys, I would not have been able to have that conversation before I did this podcast. And because I've been also thinking about, like, what does it mean to be a sex nerd to me? I don't know about you, but for me, sex nerding and sexuality and intimate relationships, this is how I learn skills for the world. And everything that I learn translates to other fields, other areas, interacting just in the world with people, and how I deal with myself. So the skills I've learned from BDSM people, from guests, from psychologists, from polyamory skills, all of that has translated in trying to practice what I preach about integrity. I guess I don't want to just keep talking about this. What I'm saying is I had a really intense conversation, and as much as that was difficult, I also was really impressed with myself. Like, oh my God. And I appreciate you. If you have been listening to the show, I feel like I've grown a lot. I get letters from people that have grown a lot, and it's just amazing. So I just really used some friggin' adult superpowers this week. So if you have people in your life that you want to have difficult conversations with, but that you think might help you move forward in some way in that relationship, it is possible. And it feels good on the other side. Yeah, as long as you have other people in your life to give you hugs, you know, and stuff. And tell you that you're awesome, because you are awesome. Okay, enough of that. I'm being silly. Feelings. All right, moving on. Valentine's Day is coming up. It's getting closer and closer and closer. Okay. Speaking of skills, right? Like life skills. If you're trying to figure out what to do for Valentine's Day, and I realize we have a lot of single listeners, but for those of you partnered up, I solved it. I solved all of it. I mean, of course, buy them a sex toy, because sex toys are just fun to buy, because you can put them in places and it's really cool. Valentine's Day. But also, you should take a couples massage class together. I mean, dag nabbit, learn to touch each other more. I mean, how cool is that? I was just looking up in the LA area, and there are like 3-hour classes on couples massage. I was like, I want to do that. I want everybody to do that. So anyway, I solved it forever. I mean, there are other things, delicious things, beautiful things. Actually, also warning. Some of you have tweeted at me saying that when we have an ad that runs in the middle of the episode, it can be jarring to you. I do apologize, but there will be an ad in the middle of this episode. But I have to say that when I found out what it was going to be, I got really excited. So, and when you hear what it is, I think you'll understand. All right. This episode is really it is intense in my favorite kind of way. There is a mild trigger warning I wanted to let you about, because we briefly do chat about pedophilia and a few other things that are obviously like really strong taboos and squicks for people. But it doesn't get heavy. We just sort of skim along the surface a bit. But I just wanted to let you know, just in case. The author I'm talking to, Jesse Baring, he is a professor of psychology. He's a writer and just all around fascinating gentleman. The audio is kind of weird for the first 2 minutes, and then it mellows out. So just so you know, if it sounds weird, it'll get better. You'll hear a woman yelling from far, far away. That's Dr. Jen from the last episode on mindfulness. So she does a little cameo here. So that's kind of nice. Yay. All right, you crazy monkeys. Enjoy the episode. Bye. Hey, you guys. Sup, sex nerds. I am again in a mysterious and alien-feeling hotel room. This one's slightly Japanese-themed. I don't know what this is. I am at a odd 1970s style resort for the Quad S Conference, which is sexscience.org. They do their national conference once a year. And I came down to kind of crash the party to steal away. Author of the book Perv, The Sexual Deviant in All of Us, Jesse Baring. Hello.
Hello. How are you, Sandra?
I'm doing really well. We totally just ate matching burgers and talked about feelings and stuff.
I feel very intimate with you in this hotel room.
Yeah, it's just you, me, and sociologist Dr. Jen Gonzalez in the corner. Yeah.
But no, this is fantastic. Thanks for coming.
Oh, thank you. I realize that it might feel a little weird that I drove down from LA for this, but really any excuse to just be a sex nerd outside my own realm, it's a lot of fun to just sort of be like, oh, I get to, it's like find you in the wild, doing your thing.
And I'm glad we saw each other not long ago on The Young Turks. We were on a show together.
Right, The Young Turks. When I'm on camera, I kind of go blank, so I cannot even remember what we talked about. What did we do?
Something about the Halloween costumes and whether they were, you know, what's too sexy, and a couple of other issues I think that we ruminated over. But
the really important
thing was that I met you on that show, and I think that that had a lasting effect on me.
Well, good. This podcast has had millions of downloads. I'm a very important person. Not really, but it's. I don't know why. Whenever
I'm making you blush,
I'm suddenly like going blank and stuff. Also, oh my god, Dr. Jen's playing mom in the corner, taking photos. Okay, so let's just get down brass tacks here. I have brought you here today to your own hotel room because you've written this book, which perked my interest the moment I saw it while we right before we met on The Young Turks. But I'm sure you get that a lot.
It's an interesting, I think, effect that the title of the book has on people, Perv, the Sexual Deviant in All of Us. People either say, well, speak for yourself, Jesse, or, they're titillated enough to find out what exactly I'm trying to say in the book.
See, my expert eye, not really. When I see that, I see a book that might give people hope that they're not as weird as they're afraid they are.
That's absolutely true. I mean, that's definitely one of the themes in the book, that there is no normal, no easy to define normal, because it fluctuates so much over time and across individuals in the same society, in the same era, and across cultures. What is normal is difficult to pin down. And I also think it's not a very meaningful question in any sort of moral sense. To ask what's normal tells us very little about whether it's okay. It's just a number, what's normal. It's the majority does a certain thing that makes it normal in a statistical sense, but it doesn't say anything about whether it's right or wrong.
So when I talk to people about sex, there's often this phrase, people like in society, .. And people have this concept of what people think normal is, or what people, other people think normal is. Like, since you're talking about deviance, what do people think is normal? Like, what is the bubble that you're supposed to fit into? Because we're going to talk about what is not in that bubble of safety.
Well, I think traditionally, of course, it was just heterosexual couples. Traditionally, they're married, having fairly standard vanilla missionary style sex. That's the normal sort of throughout much of the 20th century. And I think, you know, more recently, the concept of normal has been expanding. And I think that's a good thing in some ways, to include, homosexuals, for instance. I'm gay, as a gay man, I've definitely benefited from this rethinking in society over what is normal. But again, that doesn't necessarily mean it's terribly useful as a construct when we're thinking about whether it's good or bad. But
people sure like to label
what's normal, what's natural. Really, the only question that I try to get into in the book in terms of what the relevant question is what's harmful, really defining what is harmful. And I think that that's something that I want to move the discussion toward, defining harm properly from the subjective perspective of the people having sex, or the feelings that they have.
Would say what is harmful be kind of asking the opposite question of would be the other side of what is healthy? Because that's the question I often ask, is not what's normal, but what is healthy? Would harmful be the exact opposite? Like, could we like draw a line between those two?
In some ways, and I definitely don't want to give the sense that defining harm is easy, because if you think about homosexuality, for instance, there was a period of time, even after it was removed from the DSM as a psychiatric illness, as a disorder, there was still a diagnostic category called ego dystonic homosexuality, which applied to gays and lesbians that...
Can I guess? Is it for people who are attracted to other people who look a lot like them?
No, that's something else altogether.
Okay, I just wanted to guess.
No, these are people that they don't like the fact that they're gay. You know, they really hate the fact that they're gay. So they try to change themselves to being heterosexual. So, what was harmful was not, you know, not their sexual orientation. What was harmful was the society that they were living in. The society was sick. It wasn't them. It wasn't, you know, them being gay, that they weren't the ones that were ill.
Is that still in the DSM as a thing?
No, it's been removed too, fortunately. But there are lots of other diagnostic categories for sexual deviance that would qualify in that same way. I think they're considered to be inherently harmful when sometimes it's not immediately apparently so that that's the case.
Wait, they are judged to be harmful, but they don't seem to actually be harmful.
They're in the DSM, and they can be you can be diagnosed with one of these paraphilias, or really they're just an orientation. I use the word orientation to refer to not just sort of gay, bi, or straight, but what our brains orient to sexually or genitals orient to sexually, regardless of the political implications, you know, the use of that word orientation, that to me is an orientation. You have no control over it. But in the DSM, you know, there are still orientations that are in there because they are assumed by the clinical community to be inherently harmful.
Like being in love with the Eiffel Tower. I remember seeing a blurb.
It's not in there. No, some of the more, that is definitely a paraphilia. That's called objectophilia.
Oh, sexual.
Yeah, or objective sexuals. Yeah, so these people are attracted to inanimate objects because they see those objects as actually having some type of personality, including sexual desires and feeling desires for them. But that's a different conversation, I guess. But there's a list of paraphilias in the DSM still that are in there because clinicians see them as being, you know, representing an illness or being because they are harmful. So, for instance,
examples.
So, sadism, masochism, transvestic fetishism. Transvestic fetishism is not always assumed to be harmful, but if the person is experiencing personal distress for having that, they would still be diagnosed as having a mental illness.
Wait a minute, but wouldn't homosexual ego, what did you call
it? Dystonic homosexuality.
That one, or what you just said, anything where you're feeling distress about the thing that you naturally have.
But
wouldn't that be like a shame thing or something else? Yeah. That would be a self-hatred thing.
That's the thing. So, you know, where does the personal distress come from? That's the question. You know, is the personal distress itself a product of living in a society that has rejected them for something that they have absolutely no control over, and may or may not be harmful in terms of other people's subjective well-being? Or is it somehow intrinsic to the orientation itself? And I don't think that's the case usually. Under most conditions, it's a product of the society that we live that causes that personal distress. You're distressed, obviously, if the rest of society is going to reject you. You're not going to be terribly, you know, have a very positive self-image in terms of your sexual feelings.
These are big things. These are big ideas.
Yeah. But it's not all too academic and technical and clinical. You know, there's some entertainment value in there too, because there are lots of really fascinating, kind of bizarre, carnival like paraphilias out there that, you know,
what's your favorite?
I first read about melissophilia, and that sounds like a really nice sort of sexual orientation.
I really like bitches named Melissa. Hey.
Yeah. So, It's not really being attracted to women named Melissa, surprisingly. It's an attraction to stinging insects. It's Greek for bee. So these are people that can only get off if there's a wasp or a hornet or a bumblebee or, you know, something in the bedroom or on their bodies that triggers their arousal.
The actual stinging or just the presence?
Someone far away from the mic is asking if it's the actual stinging or just the presence of it.
There aren't many on record, Melissa files, surprisingly. So I think it's probably mixed. You know, some probably like the sting, the sort of pain, the masochism associated with it. And others just like them being there. Maybe it's the buzzing that turns them on.
Right. It's just like any kind of sexual interests. Each person is a unique snowflake, even within the stinging insect category.
Fingerprint. That's what I like to say.
Erotic fingerprint.
It's unique to each of us. Of course, we don't, you know, lots of things go unsaid in terms of what can turn us on. And that's what I try to get at in the book, you know, the sort of unspoken dimensions of our sexuality, things that we wouldn't admit on a questionnaire or survey or an interview, for that matter.
Is your idea in that whether we admit it to ourselves or not, whether we admit it to someone else, even if we're not aware of it, there are things that might be considered a paraphilia, and also paraphilia being defined as a deviant or out of the ordinary sexual interest. Is that how you define paraphilia?
Yeah. Well, literally it translates to love outside the norm.
That's pretty simple.
Right. But I think it's probably better seen as, and in fact, there used to be an old fashioned word called paralognia, which was maybe more fitting. It was lust outside the norm.
Oh yeah. That does well.
Because, you know, really we're talking about sexual arousal with paraphilias. It's not about love or romance. It's about what turns us on physiologically. And there is a difference between that sort of basic primal physiological level of what pushes each of our buttons and what we self-identify as. And sometimes I think in the ideal world, what I'd like to see is a better matching of those two levels at the individual. But oftentimes it's completely in contrast. We try to hide what we are aroused by, and we take on an identity that is completely in stark contrast and has a tension with that other level.
Like, I'm a vanilla, monogamous, heterosexual female, but girl-on-girl videos turn me on, and I'm really into the movie Secretary, like that.
Yeah, well,
but I would call myself vanilla, or
even that. Who knows what you're hiding? I mean, you've told us some interesting facts about yourself, but there's still, but who knows what the real Sandra actually is? And
anyone who listened to this podcast knows that is not the definition of who I am. I was making up things.
Hypothetical, I see. Yeah, that's interesting. But
I'm wearing a cowboy shirt. This is, I'm flagging for something.
Yeah. No, in fact, you know, me saying that I'm a gay man, that's actually a complete lie. I'm really just your heterosexual. This is all just part of the image for writing the book. I needed to be a deviant in some way. No, I'm kidding. I am gay. I talked tonight at this conference, how my first experience with another man was really with a Neanderthal masturbating to an image of a Neanderthal, my dad's old anthropology textbook, a naked, well-built Neanderthal.
Do you find yourself attracted to bear type men since?
Sometimes, yeah. The Neanderthal was not exactly sort of my ideal. He's just the only naked guy I could find at the time. No, I have a thing actually, and you just saw my partner. I showed him to you. I have a thing for Latino males, and I think, you know, maybe I spent a lot of time in South Florida and some sort of imprinting that was happening in response to that experience.
This brings me, okay, this is twofold. One, being a gay male and you just presented a section of your book is about the visceral feeling of disgust and how that influences how we judge things like homosexuality, etc. So being a homosexual male writing this book, were you on any sort of personal quest in terms of trying to make sense of how the world perceives you, or was it purely academic? Like, was there any sort of arc in terms of your own knowledge for that relationship with society? / even though I asked this question at dinner, I have to ask again. Have you figured out what makes us into certain things? Like, has anyone figured it out? Because I want to know, like, why I had bondage fantasies from a very early age, and I don't remember any movies, and that is really specific.
As a child,
I was spanked as a child. No, but there was no violence or impact in my fantasies. It was no. It was just purely bondage. Mm. And like a nice conversation while I was tied up. That's it. It was purely just a bondage element.
And when was your first earliest memory of this bondage arousal?
Probably like second grade, but it was like romance. Like it would be like the boy that I had a crush on would like find me accidentally in bondage and but he wouldn't really untie me. Right. I'd be submissive or like there would be a power thing and
permission. I have all sorts of responses to that. I mean, I think your case is really interesting. So maybe we could talk about that more later.
We can talk about it. I don't care. Yeah, no, I don't care.
There are all sorts of speculative theories about the origins of what of our particular kinks and fetishes or paraphilias. And I should say that there's a difference between a kink like that, for instance, versus a certifiable, clinically diagnosable paraphilia. To have a paraphilia means that you are erotically dependent on that one thing. You can only get off on that, or you are highly dependent on it, at least.
Okay, I thought clinically the word fetish was what people used to describe that, but is it paraphilia?
A fetish is a subtype of paraphilia. So there are fetishes for objects, and that's usually the most common form of a fetish.
Okay,
and then, so people use the word fetish, I think, they use it very casually and,
it's expanded in its meaning,
but from a sort of like academic technical perspective, a fetish is a type of paraphilia. But in any event, there are all sorts of, interesting speculative theories about, why you, for instance, would like bondage and most of those deal with some type of developmental imprinting. Something happened, even if you're not aware of it, perhaps, in your early childhood that stamped itself irrevocably onto your brain and, what aroused it. Maybe you just happened to be titillated at that point in time as a child. That had this sort of emotional residue sort of in your adult, sexual response pattern now. And that's much more common with boys though, than it is with girls. Boys that have men that are openly paraphilic, whatever it is, there's lots of work. Most of the work actually is with foot fetishism. And I find feet just absolutely disgusting and revolting. So it's really difficult for me to read about that material, but it's completely harmless, obviously. And it's something that I think that they should indulge in if it's fun for them and it turns them on. But, a lot of foot fetishists will say that, they remember very distinctly, massaging their parents' feet under the covers when they were, a little kid and, the parents sort of, encouraging them to do that, groaning, feeling good or wrestling with an older brother and the brother's feet just happen to be sort of dangling in your face and you happen to have an erection at that time. And, and it's set on the tracks at that point. You can't turn it back. And it's surprisingly young. It's like, people say that this happened between the ages of 4 and 9. When most people, I think, don't consider children to even have any sort of sexuality, but that's when the things are really happening that turn us into the particular characters we are as sexual adults. At least for males, again, this is a much more recurrent pattern with male sexuality than it is with females. Female sexual arousal seems to be much more,
vague. It's effing vague. Everything turns me on.
You get aroused by it's fluid. That's the word they use. It's erotic plasticity, or it's erotically fluid in the sense that you can get aroused potentially by all sorts of things. Whereas men are much more likely to get fixated and locked into something specific, a very certain type of person or act that turns them on.
Women are just better multitaskers, man. We just have a broader range of attention.
Thank you.
I love how people have these sort of wisdoms about what men versus women and things that aren't necessarily possibly.
But a lot of this actually is supported by the physiological arousal studies. So you show women, you show women all these, bonobos having sex, or, lesbians look at pictures of naked men, straight women look at pictures of other women, and women get aroused by absolutely everything. But it's also, there's a disconnect between their conscious arousal and their genital responding. Yeah. Men know when they have an erection, they know when they're turned on, they know what they like, basically. Is much more of a direct line. Mm-hmm. The penis is sort of a divining rod to their erotic reservoir. And But there are, you know, there are cases of women too that have, you know, they tell these stories of sexual imprinting. I remember, I mean, your example actually reminded me of this case of a woman that was into, spanking as an adult. And she remembered when she was a kid, a little girl, her stepfather caught her masturbating, and, you know, put her over his knee and started spanking her. And she also noticed, at the time while he was doing this, she was still aroused because she had just been masturbating. She didn't finish. But also she looked and she saw his penis, the man's penis, for the first time through the slit in his pajama pants. And so from that moment on, at least in her mind, that's when it all started in terms of her S&M sort of fantasies and, you know, really wanting to be the submissive in the relationship and being spanked.
Wow, that is so clear in her mind, yeah. That all of that, that's amazing. Wait, get close. You gotta be close. That's the rules. It's the rules of the podcast game is you can't be hollering from the bed. All right. Hello. Hello, Dr. Jen. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sandra.
Yay, sex nerd Sandra.
Now, yeah, I'm curious. Do you have memories of being held down by a sibling or a cousin or wrestling around or being held under a blanket or anything like that?
Not really. I was the oldest and kind of a loner, even as a child. I just read a lot of books.
You fantasized about it, though.
I just remember it being because I had a very strong...
You must have gotten the image from somewhere. I mean, you must have read about it or seen it on TV or like...
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, it was like, I remember it was probably, like there was a circus and it seemed very much like it was, yeah, I'm not a clown fetishist yet.
Are there clowns in this?
No. that like the bad guys who had tied me up had kind of gone away. And then the person who was going to save me or whatever, just like was like cute. And I was, in my underwear. I remember totally being uncomfortable with the idea of being naked or there being anything sexual. It was just like really exciting to be found like tied up. But like it feels like I've seen that in like tons of cartoons as a kid. You know, like it's a simple theme.
Being tied up and having to be saved and the romantic aspect of it. Yeah.
There's some cartoons with like on the railroad tracks, like a damsel is tied up and left on the railroad tracks. And I didn't see it sexually, but you did though.
Well, like, yeah, it just, we integrated. But I mean, I have an experience as an adult where I didn't find shoes or like leather.
Is that something too? Is it just the ropes or just the handcuffs turn you on?
Now as a sex educator, I think of, wrist damage. You know, when I think of handcuffs, there's absolutely no erotic charge. I'm like, throw those away.
Right.
But I don't get particularly, I mean, honestly... I mean, it's just sort of this odd memory.
I did want to say though that although the paraphilias themselves are much more common, they're much more common with men. The paraphilia that's more common with women compared to the others, it's still more common with men overall, but is sadomasochism. Mm-hmm. And even within sadomasochism, though, women are far more likely to be the masochist in the relationship than the sadist in the relationship. There are plenty of women that are dominatrixes and so on, but overwhelmingly, and if you, I mean, think 50 Shades of Grey probably reflects this in many ways, although it was a horrible book, literary-wise, anyway.
Yes. I
think that played off of this very much what you're describing here. I think it's quite common, at least if you go by those standards, that women have some degree of masochistic fantasies.
So within studying females, the paraphilia of sadomasochism is much stronger than any other paraphilias with women.
Yeah, I mean, some sexologists, the experimentally based ones, think that it's as high as 99 paraphilic men to one truly paraphilic woman. There's even controversy over whether there's any such thing as a true female pedophile, which I think is really interesting because you hear that all the time with teacher scandals and that sort of thing. But they use that word. The clinical, sexologists, they use this word pedophilia very differently than the rest of the culture or society uses that word. It's not, so a woman that, a high school teacher that's having sex with her hairy chested, senior student, is not technically a pedophile.
What's the other word for after they hit puberty? It's different than pedophile.
So this is this category of, it's called the erotic age orientations is the area that we're talking about. So there are, several, I think five,
There's five different levels.
Yeah, there's pedophilia, and the true pedophilia is attraction to pre-pubescent children. There's hebephilia, which is attraction to pubescent aged children, sort of the Lolita sort of complex, you know, right on the crux of adolescence or puberty. And then there's ephebophilia, which is older adolescence. So I don't know, generally speaking, and this gets even more complicated.
Barely legal?
Barely, not even legal, actually. Oh. I mean, it's probably more like 15, 17, something like that. It depends on the physical maturation, not the chronological age. And I can talk about that in a minute more, but and then there's, or not.
There's other stuff I really want to get to.
Yeah. And then there's, teleophilia, which is attraction to sort of regular age, normal, you know, reproductively aged adults. Then there's gerontophilia, which is attraction to the elderly.
Oh, is this the first time you've heard this, Jen?
Yeah, I haven't heard this breakdown before. I heard like the first one or two, I think, but not otherwise.
And it seems to be these erotic age orientations seem to be, with men in particular, to be just as static and locked into place as they're, you know, being gay, bi, or straight. You know,
but you're saying that these are tendencies. I mean, these are just categories of different maturation that you might find someone attractive.
Respond to most strongly to in terms of your sexual response.
But a paraphilia would be you'd be dependent on that age range, that you'd have to have somebody there.
Whether you want to call that a paraphilia or not, you know, certainly the use, I think pedophilia is definitely used in the sense of being, you know, it's called a paraphilia. Hebephilia was going to be added to the DSM, but it was ultimately rejected for all sorts of reasons. But most people don't consider the other ones paraphilias, maybe gerontophilia, but
just in terms of to understand the word pedophilia, because I mean, we use that word to describe anyone.
If there's somebody under the legal age is sort of the way that we use it in contemporary society, but
to use it in the DSM, like the book that's the psychiatrists use to
all sorts of qualifying criteria. So I can't remember all of them, but you know, you've got to sort of have a recurrent, persistent desire for juvenile, you know, reproductively immature children for like at least 6 months or something.
Okay. So it's not just they can only become sexually aroused.
It is pretty much that. But the standards for being diagnosed are probably even looser than they could be, I think. So most pedophiles will tell you that they, from their earliest memory, they remember that they could only get aroused by children. And the other age categories as well.
Yeah, I have a question, because a lot of the pedophiles we see that are in the news, they're married men. And so are we to presume that they have no sexual relations with their wives?
Well, there's a difference between, not all, one thing is that not all child molesters are technically pedophiles. So a lot of the married men, they may or may not be certifiable pedophiles, but they could be what's called opportunistic offenders, which is that technically, if you were to give them these sort of physiological tests of arousal and so on, they actually are more aroused by adults. It's just that they have some horrific, like, inhibitory problem, or they were on drugs, or they were inebriated or something, and they abused a child. But they're not pedophiles, diagnostically speaking. To be a pedophile requires, again, this sort of erotic dependence, if not a complete lack of attraction to adults.
Okay, so bringing it to the harm idea. Now, most people, I've noticed, have an intensely visceral sense of disgust and judgment around, well, you know, the pedophilia. You know, that's like a big taboo in terms of, you know, like just the big ones.
There are others. I mean, necrophilia, zoophilia, but definitely pedophilia, because we're dealing with a very vulnerable group of human beings, with these young children. Right. So of course, you know, this is something that I think rightly so people feel very strongly about.
Right. And so it's just, it comes, it's a big deal. Now, of course, there are pedophiles who do not act on.
Very important, I think, to remember, you know, there are, and who knows how many there are, because if they're not already in the system for committing a crime, you know, maybe they're leading successful lives, inhibiting their actions because they don't want to harm children. You know, they really understand the fact that this is devastating potentially to a child. And they have successfully controlled their deviant arousal response to children. And I think that we should be supportive of those people. You know, they can't control their desire for children. They had no choice. I mean, who would choose to be a pedophile? It'd be a horrible existence to not be able to have any sort of sexual gratification. And I think it's easy to understand that it's not a choice in the sense that, you know, for most of us, you know, we can't just decide, oh, I'm going to be attracted to an 8-year-old, or I'm going to be attracted to, if you're drawn to, you know, an 80-year-old. You can't make a decision to be attracted to what you're simply not. You know, just like I'm a gay man, I can't choose to be attracted as lovely as you are. I can't because I'm a 6 in the Kinsey scale in terms of being gay. I can't.
There's still a chance. Oh, wait, no, 6 is. No,
6 is all the extreme. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Sorry, I always forget. I always say imagine 1 to 7.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Darn it. So, but I love your goatee.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. So I think, you know, when we're talking about orientations, no matter what they are, even if they are harmful, it's still not something that the person has decided to be.
Right. So I 100% appreciate anyone who has an urge to be with somebody else who it would be harmful for that other person and they are holding back. So pedophiles that aren't acting on it, thank you for not doing that.
Yeah, Dan Savage talks a lot about, I think this is a good organization too. It's the Virtuous Pedophiles, they're called. You know, these are people that that have come together and recognized the fact and identified as pedophiles, but they understand that this is harmful to children and they can't act on it. So, I think that we should be encouraging people to be honest about their orientation, and because you shouldn't be ashamed of something that you have no control of. You should be ashamed for things that you've done wrong to others and causing harm to children, obviously, is one of those.
Mm-hmm. So in the theme of harm that you're asking in this book of what is actually harmful. I mean, you can go through all the paraphilias, but like just something that's common in the news and to be talked about, and just homosexuality. That's a thing. It feels pretty common. And yet some people see it as being harmful or being negative or somehow being a detriment to society. And like what, and a lot of it doesn't come from a logic place. It just comes from a feelings place. But for people who just are so uncomfortable with something like that, you know, how do you use logic speak or work through that when there are the bad feelings?
Well, for your most sort of recalcitrant, diehard bigots, I'm not sure you can really make much progress with them. I think they're kind of a lost cause. But I think slowly, new generations are sort of replacing them and are more rationally minded, more scientifically literate, and have a better understanding. And I think we need to make this clearer to people that just because something disgusts you doesn't mean that your gut feeling of disgust is in any way reflective of whether it's right or wrong. If a woman put her, you know, a vulva in my face right now, even if she's the most, like you, the most beautiful woman in the world.
That
wouldn't be something. It's not that I'm just indifferent to it. I actually would find it aversive. You know, it's, you know, whether I need to have therapy because of it, I'm not sure, but nevertheless, but still I understand that just because I have that personal subjective experience with a woman doesn't mean that all heterosexuals are disgusting and gross and they shouldn't have sex and they shouldn't have the right to marry and so on. So I think, applying that argument to gay people, if you're straight, you know, it's disgusting to have anal sex or something just because you don't want to do it or be with somebody of the same sex makes it wrong is just completely philosophically flawed as a position, as an argument. I think that there's a huge moral impediment with religion, to be honest. I mean, I think as long as people subscribe to the view that God created our genitals to be used for one particular purpose, and that's for reproduction, then we're going to run into this brick wall constantly. So what I think we need to do is to be better versed and have a open conversation about the role of our emotions and our gut feelings and especially disgust, which was the topic of my talk tonight, and how that is not a good moral guidepost for thinking in terms of human rights with sexual variation. And also, you know, getting to the bottom of the myth of a creator that had a particular type of sexual orientation or sexuality in mind for, you know, what's right and what's wrong. As long as we're sort of harping on those two silly things, disgust and God, when it comes to sex, you know, we're going to be speaking in circles in terms of the arguments about things like gay marriage.
We are never going to get bored, you know, if we just keep going in that circle.
Yeah.
Good times.
Yeah.
Right, guys?
Keeps us working.
Dr. Jen just said keeps us working. Yeah. Yeah. I'm like, can't we solve all these problems so I can like go and be a nutritionist or do something else?
Nutrition isn't as much fun.
Yeah. I'm really into food though.
Affects sex and
yeah. And it's food's sexy. It's very sensual. It's
Especially with oral sex. I think it's particularly important.
Speaking of food, hey, you guys, guess what? It's time for that ad. And you know what? I am so excited about this ad, actually, because we are sponsored here at the Sex Nerd Sandra podcast this week by Sherry's Berries. Go to berries.com, berries.com, and type in Sandra. You'll go to the website. It's basically a food porn website. Everything looks ridiculously delicious. It's gourmet chocolate food, berries dipped in sprinkles and little like fancy toppings. And it's, my mouth watered and my eyes watered. Like everything was, I was crying and I was hungry. It was beautiful. Anyway, go to berries.com. There's a microphone in the top right-hand corner. Click it, type in Sandra, and you get like 40% off. It'll show you, but it's like a half dozen giant, juicy, gourmet chocolate dips berries. Oh, so good. And for 10 bucks more, you get a whole dozen. And really, honestly, it's so good. So yeah. It's gourmet, y'all. So thank you, Sherry's Berries, for sponsoring us this week. Again, berries.com. Our special code is Sandra. That's me. All right. And let's get back to this crazy episode. Well, I just think about all the other, like, I'm impassioned about so many things, but I feel like working in the sexuality field is going to be something I'm going to be doing for a long time because it's going to take us probably a couple hundred years to hopefully get to a place of health.
How far we've come in a really short period of time. I mean, 100 years ago, girls in Manhattan, in London, in Paris, they were actually getting clitoridectomies because they were masturbating. Their parents were so, you know, shocked and outraged that their teenage daughters would be doing such a thing that they literally removed their organs of pleasure.
I mean, we've gotten far, but I still think it's going to be at least four generations of humans. You know, I mean, it's going to be at least 100 years if we're going in the right direction before, you know, a lot of sexual negativity and like things that our parents told us and things that our parents' parents told them. And like,
it's not only, I mean, I do think that sort of cultural changes in society makes a big difference, but I think that we also have to take into consideration our evolved psychological biases and the reason we find some types of sexual behaviors aversive, you know, thinking about disease transmission and contamination. A lot of those things are, you know, potentially innate, and they influence our thinking about other people's sexual behavior. So to get past that in a moral way, we almost have to override the way that our brains have evolved to work, you know. And that's, you know, for somebody who is takes the naturalistic argument or commits the naturalistic fallacy, they'll say that's not a good thing because, you know, why should we go against the way that we've evolved to be? That's not looking at the question clearly. That's to say that, you know, our brains work some particular way because it was the most moral way to work, or the
thing is, though, and to bring in politics a little bit and global politics, you know, anytime fear gets evoked in a big way, we kind of go backwards because then we don't worry about our civil liberties in the same way. And because we're being played for just, you know, our basic survival around fear and 9/11 and things like that. So, I mean, we've made a lot of progress in the past 100 years, 150 years, But then, I mean, look at the sexual revolution, and now we've gone backwards since some of that. So it's kind of unpredictable how it's going to play out.
I think a lot of that is just sort of pushback from the success of the gay rights initiatives and people in sort of in a large scale actually being much more, you know, humane, but also, you know, really sort of flushing out that ultra conservative contingency in the population that become more aggressive in their argumentation.
Yeah. We're playing a political bunny hop, I think. Yeah. You know,
it could, you know, it could get worse before it gets better. I think that's what you're saying.
It's unpredictable. It's unpredictable. It doesn't just yet keep going linearly in a positive, at least what we would call positive, sex positive, compassionate acceptance path. It's not a straightforward path.
No, it's not a straight line. It's a winding line. It's a very winding, confusing, annoying line.
Well, we're all in it together.
Yeah, I think, are we all annoyed in this room?
Yeah.
Okay, wait. Now I'm like totally going blank as to where I wanted to finish it off. I was so excited, and then I got blank. Right. first of all, wait a minute. Have you heard the word squick?
Squick? No, I don't think I have, actually.
I have, I've noticed it used with sex educators. They'll say like, that's your squick, like the, or like, ooh, that's my squick, scat play. That's a squick of mine. It's like a word to describe. Yeah. A word that, a feeling, like a judgment feeling, like, yeah, I get slightly nauseated. I kind of want to throw up when I think about scat play, but I also know that that's my squick. Yeah, I'm not judging
like
you.
Squicked me out or something like, yes, that. I think I have heard that.
How do you spell that word?
I don't know. It's a new made up word.
UICK, I would imagine, right?
Yes, or a CK or K. I don't know if people are even spelling it. It's just the thing that it's been introduced. I think Kate McCombs with my sexualityprofessor.com. Oh, it's not to say that everyone has one, but it's, I think what would be really helpful in teaching people skills around judgments and being able to identify is you just need more self-awareness to be able to like, oh, I'm having a judgment. I'm having a trigger. I'm having a reaction right now. How many people are taught that growing up? Not many.
Well, and like through, I guess, sexuality educators or counselors or therapists, you can take a SAR. Have you ever taken one? Sound of this section?
No, I experienced the wall of porn at the, San Francisco sex information, sex ed training, okay. But I haven't experienced the 10-hour SAR, training. Tell me everything.
Well, yeah, SAR is like a sexual attitude reassessment. So for, you know, depending, you could do it for a weekend or a week or whatever, a few days. And they just kind of bombard you with porn on different screens and speakers. And then they break you into groups and facilitate in small groups of what aroused you, what pushed your buttons, what made you uncomfortable, what viscerally made you uncomfortable, whatever. So it's exactly what you're talking about, and it's teaching us to take ownership of that so we can be better of, you know, better service to our students and all. But I love if it's coming into more like mainstream conversation around this, about people taking ownership of their triggers, because in general, any triggers around sex, if you trigger me around sex, it's your fault and I don't have to take responsibility for it. So this is nice.
I mean, it was you know, when we were engaging in scat play earlier this evening, I did want to make the point though that I think it's not inconsistent for somebody to be you know, compassionate, humane, logically minded, but also not be terribly kinky. Like, actually, I think I'm quite prudish in the sense of like my own like emotional you know, sensibilities in terms of my, you know, my sexual desires. Quite aside from being gay, you know, I like pretty much straightforward sex with my partner. You know, we're not really into kink.
You did call the vulva in one of your slides with the syphilis like sizzling bacon strips.
Yeah.
And I heard so many visceral reactions to that, like, oh, like, just a lot of women were not happy about that description.
There was a lesbian sitting next to me and she was pissed about that.
Syphilitic. They were actually upset about syphilitic.
You called the woman's vulva looking like.
I was talking about the fact that it was syphilitic. That's why I was referring to it as sizzling bacon strips.
I think beef curtains being generally.
I would have said the same thing about male, you know, anatomy too, if it looked like that. Yeah, but it was pretty hideous and oozing and weeping. And it was anyway. But I do think that it's possible to you know, to own and to sort of not embrace, but to acknowledge the fact that you do have these sort of instinctive responses to whatever it is, these squicks, as you say, but also also to be, to understand that they aren't very informative or useful or interesting, in terms of what's right or what's wrong, and letting other people do it if that's what they want to do. We don't have to, we don't all have to be totally kinky and like do whatever, you know, everything goes. If we don't want to, it's whatever you want to do as long as it's not harmful. That's the bottom line.
That is totes the bottom line. I want to conclude this with a question. I want some clarity on this because you presented a little bit of it in your presentation earlier about the, it felt like an inverse relationship between arousal and disgust, that the more turned on you are, I mean, I'm making this overly simplistic and all that, but the more turned on you are, the, how much your disgust, your squicks get turned down. But I didn't quite catch it, like general versus specific triggers and females versus males. There was a difference. And could you just break that down? Because I, for me, I have heard of research of like men masturbating, getting really turned on, and taking surveys before and after they were turned on about violence toward women and different things like that. And that when men are turned on, they tend to be more open to that sort of thing. But I think that was such a narrow scope. And I feel like people aren't that aware of how our brains and our perceptions change around so many things. I think that's really interesting.
Yeah. So sexual arousal changes our reasoning, you know, our cognitive patterns. And there have been all these, lots of interesting studies actually looking at, you know, you get like college students like super aroused by, you know, telling them to go masturbate in a room or something. And then you either ask them these questions, like you just, you know, like you just mentioned, like, is it okay to have, you know, to sexually coerce a woman if she's not interested in you? Is it, would you be willing to have sex with a morbidly obese, woman or an elderly woman, or, you know, things that they wouldn't do under normal conditions when they're not aroused, they find, you know, they're much more willing to just, when they're turned on. These are men.
The spectrum of questions hits a lot of things that often that turn off
and
people.
Harmful, potentially very harmful too. And so you're in a totally different mindset when you're aroused. Basically, you become maybe even a different person. And there is an evolutionary argument to that, that, you know, it was important like hundreds of thousands of years ago in terms of just, you know, mindless genetic replication, spreading one's genes, to be able to get over whatever you're disgusted by, to have sex with whatever could potentially bear offspring, even if it's just the remotest chance. It's if you're a man, you've got billions of gametes, sperm cells, and they're completely inexhaustible. So, you know, why not, you know, ejaculate as much as you can possibly afford to. But women, you know, women, it's different, because women that have sex while they're ovulating and are high risk of conception actually are taking a huge risk in evolutionary terms, you know, because they're going to be burdened with a child for, you know, and again, this is the fact that this basically means that we are operating today with a brain that evolved, you know, tens of thousands of years ago, if not hundreds of thousands of years ago, in terms of these mechanisms. So before prophylactics were in place and so on.
I mean, I just wanted to, because I was confused that if a woman is ovulating, they found that what she found deviant or gross. So something that she found disgusting beforehand, she became more disgusted by it when she was turned on.
That's right.
And if she weren't ovulating, then the thing that she found gross before she was turned on, she would find less gross.
But these are things that are, she finds things more gross that are, genetically nonsensical. So like having sex with animals or having sex with, an elderly man who, you know, potentially wouldn't be around to help her raise the child, incest or things like things that would be, particularly deleterious for her genes if she were to get pregnant under some, you know, by having sex with one of these characters.
Like if you take a man and having sex with an older woman, and a woman having sex with an older man, assuming that they're both heterosexual, that would be different because the man wouldn't necessarily get the older woman pregnant, but she might get pregnant by the older.
Yeah. I mean, the guy might as well have sex with whatever.
What would be the equivalent of a woman, genetically deleterious, having sex with an older man who wouldn't be able to take care of her offspring, let's say after, what would be the equivalent to a question you'd ask a guy about something that would be genetically bad if,
There is nothing. I mean, it's kind of like you lower the standard so much that anything goes in terms of what a man is willing to do and if he's that aroused. Now, whether he would do it or not is a completely different story. Like, and so I said earlier that I'm a 6 on the Kinsey scale. Now, if I were like super, super, super horny, I don't know, maybe like a woman could get me off, with enough alcohol, maybe in my system or something. I'm not sure. But it is remotely, at least it's going to be much more possible if I'm super turned on than I am, when I'm not, in terms of my willingness to have sex with a woman or something. Yeah.
Like something like have sex with a really disturbing looking dildo versus having sex with a really disturbing looking masturbation slave, something where it's not about the fact that she's got ovaries or might make a baby, but it's like, would you hump this disturbing looking armchair? something that's just something else. I guess I'm trying to figure out all of a sudden the conversation becomes about her making babies when I think is,
well, because only because that work has, that has been done within the context of evolutionary theoretical models. So it's
boring
hypotheses, right. But
it all has the same answer. It all comes from the same reasoning, but would be the equivalent. I mean, I feel like what you're asking, Sandra, is like, what if a man, when he's aroused, then wanted sex with a 6-year-old girl, which clearly doesn't have reproductive, capabilities. Is that what you were asking? Like, what would be the equivalent of a woman then not wanting to have sex with a 80-year-old man who wouldn't be around?
Like, yeah, having asking a man having if like something disturbing like having sex with a 6-year-old girl versus asking a woman when aroused having sex with a
They actually ask on those questionnaires, those studies, would the super aroused male be willing to have sex with a 12-year-old? But they don't go younger than that. That's a sort of hepophile category that we talked about before. And so,
both the male and the female having sex with someone below the age of being able to be reproductive.
The male will say yes. The woman that is at peak risk of conception will say absolutely not. This is gross and wrong and disgusting. So a woman that's at risk of conception is actually becomes her much more moral in that sense.
But what about the woman who's not ovulating?
She'll find it wrong still, but she just won't find it as disgusting when she's has to make these critical mating decisions.
I guess because I know that things that I find kind of off, like when I'm normal, will be like, yeah, smack me, where when I'm right. Well, now everything's when I'm at rest. I don't. See, when I'm ovulating, I'm like, everything looks good right now. Like, I'm just aware of that. Yeah. So to me, of course,
these are aggregate patterns. Like, it's not like, I mean, obviously there are going to be individual differences, and that doesn't apply to every woman, not every man. And
to say like, I'm not like that, so therefore this is wrong is not, I mean, I realize how absolutely ridiculous that is to do that. And YouTube is filled with that, but it's, I wanted to really understand and find a parallel example. So thank you, Jen, for that example to really.
But I think what you started off asking was a slightly different question, which was about disgust and sort of that issue is more about sort of moral behaviors and the things that we're willing to do or who we're willing to do when we're aroused and when we're not. But then there's another question about, under normal conditions, your normal partner or whatever, what you're willing to do with them when you're horny versus when you're not horny.
If
I were to ask you, I'm assuming you're not terribly like aroused right now, but if I were to ask you, do you like swallowing fresh, warm male ejaculate, that's probably pretty disgusting. Do you want to, taste the woman's breast milk right now? Or her menstrual blood? The point is that when you are not aroused, these things are just repulsive and disgusting. We can't, it's hard for us to even talk about them and think about them. But when you're in the moment, when you're super turned on, these things become not that gross. Like somehow we get over them. And in fact, we pursue them in some ways, lots of people want to not only, they're not only willing to taste these things, they're willing to, they actually pursue them in terms of swallowing them and licking them and whatever. So the argument there is that, we've got to overcome our, being aroused, this state of lust allowed us to dampen or water down our or otherwise adaptive disgust, because we had to get on with the business of reproduction. You know, if you're too grossed out by everything, then you'll never have sex, and then you're never going to have, you know, you're never going to have any sort of genetic fitness, you know, from a cold minded Darwinian perspective anyway.
So has the field of studying lust and how our perceptions change and what we find a turn on change as we get more turned on, is that like, is there a lot of research around that, or is it just beginning? I'm just, in terms of, I'm not great on Google Scholar.
It's pretty new. I mean, I think it's a new area of research, and I think the best studies are studies that actually induce arousal in participants and then have them answer questions or expose them to different types of stimuli, than just simply giving people a questionnaire and saying, oh, you know, hypothetically, if you were aroused, would you be willing to do this? I think that you've got to get them in that state of mind and then expose them to the things that you're interested in. But of course, there are lots of ethical limitations too. You can't, you know, there are only so much you can do as a clever experimentalist in a lab. Even though these questions can be answered empirically, you can't do them because they're not always ethical.
No, for me, this seems like an important and actually an incredibly important area of study, because the implications of how our perceptions change. I mean, like blaming women for how they dress as to rape, like, you know, what is happening under there? Or like this joke that when you see cleavage, for some people, they just get kind of dumb in the brain. And like, what's actually happening there? I mean, because there is a tiny bit of arousal that's happening, although everyone should own their own reactions and everything. But like, I just find that
we trade when you're in that state, you trade in your long-term reasoning abilities for the short-term perspective gain of either pleasure or procreation. And, you hear that, you talk about, you know, female arousal, but also, you know, men, you're always accused of, you know, thinking with the wrong head, that sort of thing. But in fact, that is an adaptive strategy, because, you know, those short-term decisions led to significant reproductive genetic gains. You know, lots of us that are alive today are the product of, you know, some really, you know, hasty, lustful moments in the ancestral past where, you know, probably wasn't that wise for one of our ancestors to have sex at that moment, but they did, and here we are.
Yeah. I was an accident. I'll say that right now. Yeah. I wasn't a planned person. Oh no, I shouldn't be here.
Yeah, I think I was an accident too, actually. But yeah, it's definitely a fascinating dynamic, I think.
It's fascinating, important,
lust,
exciting.
Two opposing ends of the arousal spectrum. They work as a puller and levy system. They work as a pulley and lever system.
Ah, lust and disgust. Title of his new book. No,
but there is a paraphilia that is hard to understand. It's kind of a puzzle, which is emetophilia, erotic vomiting, or Roman showers.
You know, there's vomit lube. Someone made lube that looks and smells like vomit. Yep. Anyway, continue.
Well, there's only a handful of case studies with emetophiles. That's the technical term for this paraphilia, and they're all women, surprisingly.
No, really? And wait, for them to vomit or for somebody else vomiting?
Both. Some, you know, I've read three case studies, and for two of them, I think they were aroused by other people vomiting, and one was aroused by themselves vomiting. And they actually describe some of these early childhood experiences, like imprinting. One of them went to a Catholic school, and there was a really nasty nun or something that was kind of abusive and just a horrible person. And when she was a little girl, she saw the nun get sick in a bathroom and vomiting, and she actually felt this sort of sadistic pleasure that she was experiencing that pain.
Like erotic Schadenfreude?
Yeah, exactly. And somehow, you know, and then she said, you know, from that point forward, she used to masturbate to the image of the nun vomiting, and that was the only thing that could really get her off, this particular nun she hated so much. And, but she noticed, you know, as an adult, she became this sort of sadistic emetophile, where she wanted her partners to vomit. That would bring her pleasure. And another one associated, you know, that feeling of, she remembered being a little girl sitting on her grandmother's lap and being sick and vomiting, and her mother sort of stroking, you know, her grandmother stroking her hair, and you know, the way that she was seated on the grandmother's lap, she was just kind of aroused, I think, at that time, and then she vomited, and somehow the two went together, and you know, for the rest of her life, she was into vomiting on her reproductive partner, or, you know, her partners, and it seemed to be traced back to that singular experience.
That reminds me of aftercare, just in the BDSM community at Cal's so much. Is it the spank? Sometimes it's the spank, and sometimes it's the soft, caring rubbing after the spank. You know, it just depends. But anyway, this has been a fascinating conversation. Jesse, where can people grab your book and check you out and read what you've written and marvel at your genius?
Let's see. Well, they can get the book easily enough at Barnes & Noble or Amazon, anywhere they sell books.
Look for the coy sheep.
Yeah, there's a provocative sheep on the cover of the book, standing right over my name, actually, seductively. And they can find out more about me. I don't just write about sex, incidentally. This is just a book that I wrote. You know, I've talked about other things too, but I have a website. It's just my name, jessebaring.com, and I write for Scientific American, Slate, and a bunch of other magazines as well.
Sweet. And Dr. Jen, thank you for jumping in the chair, getting close to the mic. Where can people find you?
Oh, you can find me at drjensden.com. Thank you so much for letting me jump into this conversation. This is ridiculously fascinating.
Should we put all of our clothes back on now, or is it?
Not yet, no. Guys.
Okay. Can you get that bomb off me?
I was just like this.
I'd prefer if you kept it for the rest of the night on your body. Okay. All right. Go team fun, you guys.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.